This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week, we'll catch up with one of the world's most distinguished and revered choral conductors as he makes his farewell tour, Stephen Darlington, who after 32 years as director of the Choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, is stepping down. That will cap a long career as organ scholar, beginning at Christ Church, then on to Canterbury and St. Albans. Christ Church, a choir founded 500 years ago, had as its first director John Taverner, appointed by Cardinal Wolsey in 1526. That's his Kyrie Eleison, as sung by the choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, led by my guest. Stephen Darlington's many accomplishments include a set of 5 recordings chronicling the English choral music of composers nearly forgotten by history, from the last years of the 15th century to the start of the 16th, up to around Taverner's time, just before the Reformation. Also, my guest has championed new choral music and has performed centuries of repertoire from in between. I caught up with Stephen Darlington while on his farewell tour up at St. Thomas's in New York City last month. I am here today with Maestro Stephen Darlington. I guess congratulations is kind of what you say, but I'm not sure if you wish somebody success when they're on their farewell tour. I guess you kind of can.
Well, yes, that's right. I have to say it's a rather strange sensation, but I've been at Christchurch for 33 years.
Yeah.
So probably is time to throw in the towel.
You're at St. Thomas in New York, and you're going to be doing a concert there from when we're recording this tomorrow night. And everybody, no matter what profession, have you come to grips with the fact that you're leaving and that this is, I mean, has this all sunk in type of thing?
Well, yeah, no, not entirely. I mean, I think, you know, the wonderful thing about music is that there's so much yet to be done and yet to be discovered. So I guess, you know, I'm looking forward to doing different musical things and working with different choirs and so on. But the sense of trepidation is that the fact that I'll be losing my instrument, if you like, which is the choir that I've created, and particularly a choir like this where you work with them every day and work with children every day, it's a very special thing. And it's quite different when you go and guest conduct, you know, you have a different relationship with the group.
Take us back to the early 80s. I mean, you started there in 85, but you'd already built a career, which is very, in some sense, typical and very British. Before Christchurch, you're Canterbury and St. Albans, but you were organist choir director. So I guess that dual track is quite normal for the path you were on. Then take us up to when you were appointed. Was it a surprise? I mean, did you have to think about accepting it? What did you find when you got there? I mean, that type of thing. So take us through that transition period of coming into Christchurch.
Well, I have to say, I was actually the organ scholar at Christchurch in the early 1970s with Simon Preston.
Right, so you're coming back, actually.
So there was a sense of coming back, and I can honestly say that it never occurred to me, really, that I would come back to Christchurch. It wasn't on my radar, and it wasn't that I was persuaded to apply, but I just thought, well, I'd been at St. Albans running the show there for 7 years, and St. Albans is a wonderful place with a fabulous international organ festival, which I ran and so on. But, you know, I was still pretty young, and I thought, well, what next? So I threw my hat into the ring at Christchurch, and I suppose the attraction was the reputation, the fact that it was an opportunity to work with choral music within an academic environment, so that, you know, my responsibilities at Christchurch have been not only to run the choir, but also to be the academic music tutor and a university lecturer in music. And most of my students to pass through Christchurch have not been anything to do with the cathedral choir. And in a sense, that's been quite refreshing. And that's what appealed to me, because it meant that, if you like, the two sides of music could feed each other.
Right.
And they helped feed me.
It seems like when you took over Christchurch, though, that the percentage of organ performing versus choir conducting was going to shift. It was going to shift heavily towards the choir conducting, correct?
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think that had already happened. When I was there as organ scholar, the tradition was still very much that whoever was the organist and choir master quite often played and accompanied the choir, and someone from within the choir would tap a beat. And it, you know, so it obviously it had its limitations as far as interpretation was concerned. And it was really during that period in the 70s when the shift took place, I would say, that now it would be very uncommon to find that sort of formula in English cathedrals and churches, where you just have an accompanist and no conductor. But I suppose, you know, in the end, although I did a lot of organ playing in my early years back at Christchurch, actually I ended up concentrating more on the conducting.
When you got there, of course, you were falling into a line of succession that goes back to 1526.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about a little about the makeup of the choir, but when you first got there, to take us back to the mid-80s, when you started to, were there things, not casting any light on your predecessors, but were you things you knew you wanted to build and establish in your first few years there? Was there a direction you wanted to take them?
Well, yes, in a sense, I did want to try to develop the repertory of earlier music, which, you know, have already been covered to some extent by Simon Preston and my immediate predecessor, Francis Greer. But that was partly connected with my own discovery of it, if you like. As you pointed out, I'd come through a very traditional route. I was at school in Worcester, where we did lots of Elgar. And, you know, I went off to Canterbury, where we had a very eclectic mix of fairly traditional cathedral music, although actually in Canterbury, quite a lot of contemporary music too. St Albans was a parish church cathedral, so, you know, one needed to have that clear eye on the diocese and yet again a rather eclectic mix. Whereas at Christchurch, you know, Taverner was the first director of music there in the 16th century. I knew some of his music, but not a lot. And that was a discovery for me. So I think that's reflected in the early recordings that we made, which right. were of Taverner and William Byrd and, you know, Shepherd. And this was all wonderful, wonderful music, which works particularly well in the space at Christchurch because the acoustic is a very dry acoustic.
Here is music by my guest, Stephen Darlington, as he leads the choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, in his Jacob's Ladder. I think we should tell our listeners a little bit about the choir. I mentioned 500 years old. We've said how Taverner appointed by Cardinal Wolsey. But talk about its makeup, what the duties are, and its performances, you know, and how close is it now in 2018 to what Taverner had back in the 1520s?
Well, to answer that last question first, it's really very close because they had 16 boys at that time, and yeah. we now still have 16 boys, or okay. obviously different boys. and we have 12 lay clerks now. I think my recollection is they had 8 in Taverner's day. The forces would diminish somewhat when Henry VIII took over the college in 1546, so the number of choristers was reduced to 8. But actually, there has been, ever since the founding, since 1526, there's been, you know, boys and men singing the daily offices in the cathedral. So it's quite a tradition. And as I say, now we have 16 boys. They all go to a special school, which is called Christ Church Cathedral School. The school consists of about 175 children. The core of the school are definitely the choristers. That's its reason for existence, their education. And then the men, the altos, tenors and basses, there are 4 of each. They are a mixture of choral scholars who are undergraduates reading a variety of subjects in the college. At the moment, I've got 1 or 2 who are reading music as a subject, but also a lawyer and someone doing politics, someone doing modern languages. And then the other six men, they're called lay clerks, and they're paid a small salary and given free accommodation in Oxford. And they tend to be young singers who have done their 3 years at their university course, either in Oxford or Durham or Cambridge or places like that. And they come to Christchurch to spend a couple of years before going off and making their way in groups like the King Singers. Three of the current King Singers were at Christchurch, or the Talis Scholars or the 16 or groups like that.
The boys are brought into the choir through audition, I would assume, right?
Yes, they're auditioned when they're 7 or 8 years old. Right. And obviously there is a musical audition, but what's also critical is the academic testing that they get. Because I think to be able to make music at a high level, they need to have the intellectual capacity to sort of understand some of the concepts which, you know, as adults, we think of them as being something which, you know, one only learns when you're older. But actually, children are able to do this and, you know, respond in a very sophisticated way to musical ideas. But that's harder to do if you're not intellectually bright, I suppose.
You said how you miss this instrument that you deal with daily. And the choir, in an average week, I'm not maybe talking the middle of the summer or something like that, but how many times are they singing per week, and how much music are you preparing with them constantly?
Yeah, so they sing 6 days a week, different music at each service. On weekdays, that's just one service, that's Evensong. But at the weekends, on a Sunday, there are three services, a two on a Sunday morning and one in the evening. And then the boys, they will have a rehearsal every morning before school starts for an hour. And then they come back at the end of the day and rehearse with the choir men. So I guess they're doing, roughly speaking, 3 hours singing a day.
And of course, they do performances and tours like you're on now and recordings. Yeah. And I assume they're probably some of the greatest sight readers on the face of the earth.
Well, they certainly do get to be good sight readers because, you know, there isn't time really for them not to be.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have to say, I think that has its limitations because it's clearly very, it's very helpful to be able to pick up a piece of music and get all the notes right the first time. But I guess, you know, to sort of plumb the depths that you would want to if you're really trying to respond, you know, in a more mature way to, I'd say, music by Palestrina or something, you do need to rehearse it quite a lot and sing it quite a lot. And what's helpful about our routine is that there is repetition, not necessarily during a week, but there's repetition within the year, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you might sing Palestrina's Missa Brevis in September, but that might come round again in May or June, you know. So of course, when they sing it in May or June, it's somehow deeply embedded in their psyche.
From my guest's invaluable 5-CD set on the AV label of music from the Eton Choir book, about which we'll speak next, this music composed in the latter years of the 15th century leading into the first years of the 16th by composers many now forgotten. Here are the closing minutes of John Brown's setting of the Stabat Mater, this from Volume 1, More Divine Than Human, the choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, led by my guest today, Stephen Darlington. turning to what you've accomplished, I mean, two of your strong points have been championing music of the 20th and 21st century, and also music of an earlier time, even before the composers you mentioned, like Shepard and Byrd and stuff. And I want to talk about that first. And this is music, it's not being discovered by you, but the wealth of what you've brought to recordings. There's five volumes now on Avi of the Eton Choir Book.
Yes.
And so let's talk about this. I mean, I can give history, or you can. Henry the Sixth. I know my history, right? But in the middle of 1400s, establishes Eton College. About 50, 60 years later, this collection of music is put into print, first decade of the 1500s. 24 composers, 93 compositions. It's damaged. You only have about 60-some that are transverses, three different style changes of music. So with that set up, give us what this is, when it came into your radar, as you said, and well, start there. Yeah.
Well, yes, I think it came into my radar. You know, I'd come across it in the history books, and I'd looked at, there's an edition of it, which was groundbreaking, really done by Frank Harrison. I'd looked at them in our faculty music library and thought of doing some of this repertory at some point. And I'd heard recordings by, some excellent recordings by mixed voice choirs, like the 16 of the Eton Choir Book. And I just thought to myself, well, this music was written for a choir just like ours, which, you know, in a monastic sense was singing in a daily services, and it would be rather interesting to see whether we could do it. And, you know, I have to say that I haven't regretted it for a minute, really, because it turned out to be a revelatory experience for everybody. I mean, you know, first of all, on a purely practical level, it was a bit of a discovery that actually boys these days can sing this stuff. It is very difficult, you know, not least because of the sheer scale of many of the works. They last about, you know, quarter of an hour each.
Yeah, these are not like 3 or 4 minute motets. Some of these things go
exactly
20 minutes plus. Yeah,
exactly. They're very lengthy, sustained pieces, and some of them highly ornamented. But actually, the interesting thing is that I think it was the adults who found more difficulty responding to the style than the boys, because of course, you know, children are less, they have less deeply ingrained, prejudices is the wrong word, but sort of expectations about what musical language is like. So we have a firm idea of what the destination of a musical phrase in diatonic music is. And actually, children don't have that because they've not been around for so long. So in a way, there are fewer surprises for them in coming to terms with the language, which is, it has this mathematical dimension to it, which I think also appeals to them. And actually, they haven't particularly found it that difficult in the end.
The composers who are represented, none of them are household names.
No.
Some of them are so obscure that the only piece of music we have from some of them is in the Eton Choir Book.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe you would just want to mention a few of them, but then also tag on, was it just historical circumstance that these composers were lost to history? Was it because of the Reformation on the continent and the Reformation in England that happened so closely on the tails of this music? Or just, you know, talk about these guys who you're discovering.
Yeah, well, I suppose John Brown is probably the best known, if there is anyone who's particularly known, for his Stabat Mater. He represents the largest, you know, single composer represented in the book. Why it was lost, I think the repertory was lost because, as you say, because of the Reformation and the fact that there was no liturgical requirement anymore to perform pieces on this scale as part of the liturgy.
Right.
You know, clearly they are so long that one couldn't honestly say that the projection of the text had the sort of clarity that you'd find in the wake of the Reformation. I think of the other composers, perhaps Fairfax is perhaps the most famous. Is this Magnificat is a very important piece. And Wilkinson is another one who wrote of the extant works nearly as many pieces as Brown. I suppose the point I would particularly want to make is that, and it was a discovery for me, is that I'd imagined that this music was sort of fairly generic and sounded roughly the same. You know, in the same way that I guess if you didn't know much about music, you would think that Haydn and Mozart sounded roughly the same. You know, there were similar conventions that they were operating within, string quartet symphonies and so on, and until you got a little bit further beneath the surface, then you realise that they were very, very different composers. So the discovery for me was that, you know, Brown's music sounds different from Wilkinson's music. And, you know, Wilkinson, for example, likes huge textures. So you'll find 7 or 8 part pieces. Actually, at times, or you'd expect this music to be very horizontal in its construction and linear and all about the individual parts. But actually, there's something very special about the sonority, which is created by having that many voices, different voices. Mm. And there is, therefore, a kind of vertical dimension to this, which at times makes the music sound quite modern. By modern, I mean, you know, modern in the 16th century sense. So there's a diversity within, well, first of all, within the different compositions of a single composer.
Yeah.
But also a very recognizable diversity between composers like Brown and Wilkinson. I mean, I think of Brown as being rather as one would think of Palestrina compared with Victoria and Lassus. You know, Palestrina was perhaps the most, perfect is a wrong word to use, but the most balanced of the composers,
right.
Technically balanced. And Brown seems to have that too. He's got this, you know, you would say this wonderful combination of the vertical and the horizontal in the way that the music works.
Well, we should say again, this is pre-Reformation music in England,
yeah.
So all the texts are Latin texts. They're many of them standard Latin texts, many settings of the same text, 54 motets, there's Magnificats, there's even a Passion. I think what's also fascinating, and you're touching on it, is that even in the space of just a few decades of when this music was probably composed, the styles changed. There's like 3 almost distinct changes of styles as music evolves, and that must have been fascinating to hear that. Like you said, it wasn't all paper cut, the same music, just different. And these composers themselves were evolving as music was changing, as we moved into what we know as the era of a Josquin or somebody like that in the early 1500s.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, some of those changes are, much of this is based on Cantus Firmus, that are using some existing melody, be it chant or something. And these English composers would be pretty bold and like stick it in the top voice, almost like a chorale type of thing.
Yes, and I have a hunch, and I'd love to experiment with this one day, that there would have been quite a lot more improvisation than we imagined. I mean, my hunch about that is because, you know, sometimes you find this very elaborate decorated line, such as you've just described on a top part, sort of appearing more or less out of nowhere. And it's inconceivable to me that these singers, who were clearly very skillful, because it would be a very odd thing to write music like this, which actually the singers couldn't perform.
Right.
So, and it was essentially, you know, practical. This collection was their repertoire that they used in the chapel every day. And it's inconceivable to me that because they were doing it so regularly, that the singers would not improvise around the parts. The plain song is clearly there as a sort of point of recognition for everybody around which everything else revolves. But, you know, in my own experience in performing practice, let's say when we've done music of the 17th century by Purcell would be a good example, where I encourage the singers to, improvise in the sense of decorated cadences and
all those sorts
of things. Because, again, it's rather inconceivable that that's not what would have happened. And it's quite interesting to see as singers get more confident doing that sort of thing, that, you know, you get these wonderful flourishes which are very much in the spirit of the time. So I've never been able to experiment with doing that with the late 15th century stuff, but it would be very interesting to see whether you could perform it regularly enough to be able to develop that facility.
Also gives you a great window, just like you said, these composers weren't writing music that their singers couldn't sing. They might have been testing them or pushing them a bit, but so that the level of singing that was happening at Eton, but probably other churches and chapels in the area to be able to sing this material, especially if it kind of taxes your choristers, especially the adult voices. So
absolutely
fascinating. Is there a volume? It's volume 5. Is there a 6?
I'm afraid that at least not with Christchurch.
Okay.
See, there's certainly more material to become.
Yeah.
But 5 is it with Christchurch, I'm afraid, at least with me as director.
So let's turn to Volume 2, Choirs of Angels, from the 5-CD series of music from the Eton Choir books as performed by the Choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, led by their director and my guest today, Stephen Darlington. This, the opening minutes of Robert Wilkinson's Salve Regina. Let's flip to the other end. Choral music, kind of like wind ensemble music, at least here in the States, is kind of unique that the new music for choir, you get these incredibly hot composers and who have their music performed and they just become obsequious. They're done by choirs all around the world.
Yeah.
But you've taken a view of new choral music, even if it's composed in the last 50, 70 years or something like that. So give us an idea of how you choose the new music to perform. What is the slant towards being British composers and sort of highlighting them? Talk us about your choices of how to pick new music to perform with Christ Church or even as you go forward. You know, how do you choose that?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. You know, during my time at Christchurch, I guess I've commissioned between 40 and 50, you know, new works. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've ranged from composers like John Taverner and William Mathias and people like that to, I call it the other end of the spectrum, Howard Goodall, with whom I've worked a lot. How do I choose? That's a difficult question. I mean, one thing I've found working on projects with younger composers. I was involved in an international choral competition last year, which we did in conjunction with Bristol University, which was to try to get composers to be inspired to write on the, believe it or not, on the basis of medieval Hispanic chant, which one of my former college lecturers is a world expert in, and she's now working at Bristol University, Emma Hornby. You know, one of the problems with new music is that composers write stuff which is so difficult technically to perform. You know, you spend a lot of time rehearsing it, and we're a choir that are actually able to do that and to perform it, and then you have this fear that this music is never going to be heard again. I've often find myself saying to composers, however distinguished they might be, you know, that you just think about whether there are ways in which you could achieve the soundscape you want to achieve in a simpler way without, you know, having so many complexities. So, you know, that's one feeling. That's a practical point, I know, but it's one feeling that I have about it. I think I would want to say that I've been an advocate of Howard Goodall's music because he is one of those composers who is sort of pigeonholed as being, you know, what, crossover, I suppose you'd say, or he made his name writing musicals and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, we should say anybody who's a Mr. Bean fan, that's your choir.
That is my choir, yeah, exactly.
So, yeah,
exactly.
So that's the kind of music he can move back and forth between, okay.
The reason I got involved with him initially was because he actually studied at Christchurch, but not when I was there. And I was thinking, you know, who to commission for a piece next. I had commissioned a wonderful mass from a composer called Edward Harper, who was published by OUP, which was a marvellous piece. He wrote a parody mass for me based on a carol which he also wrote called Qui Creavit Coelum. So I was looking for something different, and I knew that Howard had written these theme tunes, and I thought it'd be quite interesting to see what he would come up with. And in the end, it turned out that it coincided with a period in his life where he was wanting to have a bit of a change of direction, because he had been a cathedral chorister himself. And so he wrote a mass for me, and that's where it all started. And what's been pleasing about the way that's developed is that, you know, he writes very good tunes, and somehow these days that's thought to be, it's a slightly pejorative thing to say about someone that they write tunes,
right.
Which is slightly strange, really, because his music does speak to people in a very powerful way, and it particularly since he has such a strong identity with text. So several years ago, we recorded a requiem that he wrote called Eternal Light, a requiem which is not using the traditional requiem text, but it's a sort of requiem for our time. And that's had now over 500 worldwide performances. So, you know, if sort of popularity and the dissemination of this music is an indicator of its success, then that's certainly been successful. Actually, we've just recorded another very big work by him, which was commissioned by a choir in Houston, which was performed there on Palm Sunday. It's called Invictus, A Passion. So that's going to be coming out in a few months' time.
Here is music by British composer Howard Goodall, his setting of Veni Sancte Spiritus, Come Holy Spirit, as performed by the Choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, led by my guest today, Stephen Darlington. Just the last question on new music, because here in the States, and it's the same over there, you have, and sometimes they're smaller choirs, chamber size, but there's groups that are kind of redefining what a choir can do and can be. I'm thinking of groups over here like Room Full of Teeth and groups like that. And I'm just wondering how that translates at all to a choir like Christ Church, which has a function and has to sing often and has a body of work. Or maybe just ball that into what is the state of choral singing. I mean, here it seems very strong. We have obviously university and church and school choirs and competitions and community choirs. So it seems very robust over here. And I'm just wondering what's the state of things in England right now.
Well, I think it is robust, and I think, not only in the sacred world, but also in the secular world, there are lots of, singing competitions and choirs of all sorts of different types that are flourishing around the place. I mean, curiously, I think it's always been the case in England that although these choirs like ours, these liturgical cathedral choirs, are well known throughout the world and make recordings and so on, actually the infrastructure is quite fragile, particularly in the university context, because you are very much at the mercy of your recruitment. You know, it's true that there are lots of talented musical children around, but it's a big decision for families to make to commit their child to specializing at such a young age and such a heavy routine. As I said, with singing, 6 days a week in the cathedral, it's a lot at a time when, there's so much diversity of opportunity available to children through the development of the media and so on. So it's by no means a given that the whole thing, can continue in its present form forever, because not just to do with recruitment, but it's also very costly. I mean, the music budget of Christ Church is about £500,000 a year, and the largest proportion of that figure goes on subsidizing the choristers' fees for their education. So, hopefully it would never happen, but there might come a time when somebody says, well, actually, isn't that rather a lot of money to be spending on something something like this, on a choir that's going to sing music from the 15th century? What's that got to do with us?
Yeah.
But to answer your question earlier on about the the flexibility of approach, obviously one with liturgical choirs, ultimately what you're doing is in the service of the liturgy. So, you can't branch out too far. Although one of the commissions I am proud of in recent years was a commission from the composer Francis Greer for a mass which was jointly done with a ballet company called the Rambert Ballet. So we had these amazing dancers, and Francis wrote the mass, which is an unaccompanied piece, with dance very much in mind. So this was certainly crossing the boundaries in an unusual way. And some people who came to the services, a bit of a shock to see dancers leaping up and down the nave.
And you got those bean counters saying, what, you want us to pay for dancers now?
Yes, that's right. Exactly. Yes.
You are furthering the demise of the cathedral chorus. My guest, Stephen Darlington, leads the Choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, in more contemporary music for choir by British composer Edward Harper, his carol called The Universe. what will you do? I mean, here's the farewell tour, and you're actually at St. Thomas, which is one of the few, if not maybe one of the only U.S. Institutions where you have a boy choir attached to a boy school.
Yeah.
Now that the American Boy Choir here in Princeton is gone. But back to you. What happens now with you?
Well, I'm hoping, you know, I've still got some energy left. And I still love doing it. And that's why I'm stopping now, in a way, at Christchurch, because I didn't want to stay so long as that people were thinking, you know, how long is he going to carry on? And,
right.
And in some senses, perhaps for the standard to go down and for me not to be aware of it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I'm hoping to continue working with choirs because, you know, I absolutely love doing that. I love the music and I love working with, people of all generations, actually, but it's the educational aspect of all of this which has always appealed to me. It's the sort of the idea that you encounter a child or a young adult at point A, and then a few years later, you know, they've reached point B and you've had something to do. You played a part in enabling them to develop their talent and to go off and do whatever they're going to do. That's something that's always appealed to me, as well as the community aspect of it all, which I find very invigorating and fascinating. You know, the idea of the whole being greater than the sum of the parts, or whatever the phrase is.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, wish you the best success going forward. I really do. And I know we'll keep hearing from you in some way.
Yeah.
So I close on my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been chatting, but with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to talk to but could. When I ask that, what's the first name that pops into your head? It can get swamped if you think about it too long.
Yeah, the first name is Elgar, funnily enough.
Really? Okay.
I think, if you need a reason for that, it's because I may have said earlier in the conversation that I was at school in Worcester. And
yeah.
I come from a musical family, but I wasn't a chorister myself. And, you know, I learned a couple of instruments. And then I just got caught up with the sort of atmosphere of Worcester and the whole place and Elgar's music. You know, I've come to be rather fascinated with this, you know, the complexity of the man, and I think he's probably a rather misunderstood composer, you know, because behind all that, he was embraced by the establishment for, you know, writing the Pomp and Circumstance marches and so on, but I don't think that's where his heart really lay.
Yeah.
So
kudos, in 13 years of this program, I mean, you are a Brit, but 13 years in this program, you're the first one to pick Elgar. Bach is the runaway number one answer.
Yeah,
but
I mean, I could, you know, if I thought more about it, there are probably some more iconic figures
sure.
I could come up with. I'd be very interested to spend a bit of time with him.
Yeah, and it'd probably be a very pleasant time, too, knowing, just reading about his personality and such, especially out at his house, too. The final question is non-musical, which everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music, and you still are going to fill your life with music. But when you have to get away, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but get a little reprise from music, what do you do if you need to step away?
Well, I'm quite a walker.
Oh. Okay.
So I like walking by the sea is actually my favorite thing of all. So, you know, my wife and I will go off to the coast, and it doesn't really matter which, you know, bit of coastline it is, but
yeah.
We'll do a long coastal walk. That's my favorite thing to do when I'm not doing music, being out in nature.
If you're in Oxford, you have to drive a little bit to get
yeah,
to find a coast.
But that's right. Yes, you can't get to the coast in less than an hour and a half.
Yeah. Well, again, congratulations on the career and now the farewell tour, and we'll hope to hear much more from you, Stephen Darlington. Thanks for taking some time.
And thank you very much. It's been really good to talk to you.
Conductor Stephen Darlington. You can find out more about him at the Christ Church Cathedral Oxford website. Think Christ Church, chch.ox for Oxford, .ac.uk. You can find out more about the choir at chchchoir.org.uk. The 5 volumes of the music from the Eton Choir book are available on the Avi Records label. Check them out at avirecords.com. I'll leave you with a true Oxford anthem by the late 19th, early 20th century composer Charles Wood, his O Thou the Central Orb, as performed by the choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, led by their now, but soon to be retired, director Stephen Darlington. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.